Committee for Tuesday, February the 20th, 2007. We're just to roadmap this a little bit. We've got members. We've got several bills to introduce as committee bills, and then we'll be proceeding through the agenda in the order it's laid out here, except that House Bill 2448 will not be heard today, but I'm not not sure that word got posted online, so let me ask, is there anyone in the audience who came to present in favor of House Bill 2448? And seeing nobody responding, then understand that House Bill 2448 will not be heard today. We will be taking up the public hearing on 2123 and then proceeding to the public hearing on House Bill 2536. Members, we have you have before you three LCs, 2890, 3630, and 3631. And the chair would entertain a motion to introduce these as committee bills, with the understanding, as always, that this says nothing about the merits of the bill, and we'll get full consideration if they're brought to
Mr. Chair, I move those bills forward as committee bills. Introduces committee bills.
Representative Barker has moved LCs 2890, 3630, and 3631 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Then LCs 2890, 3630, and 3631 are introduced as committee bills. I'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2123. Council Cummingson.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2123 establishes that a court may not invalidate a rule under ORS 183.400 solely because the rule could be applied in a manner that violates the Constitution, a statute, or a statewide planning goal.
Thank you, Council. We have signed up two proponents, Christine Shute and Lane Shatterly. Want to both come forward and explain the bill and the need for it to us.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Christine Shute. I'm the attorney in charge of the Government Services and Education section of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm also the department's in-house administrative procedures so-called expert. It's my pleasure to be here today talking about House Bill 2123. As Mr. Collinson said, this bill would amend the Administrative Procedures Act to clarify how appellate courts evaluate agency rules that are subject to legal challenge as invalid on the face of the rule. By on the face of the rule, I mean with the challenge would not necessarily take place in a situation where the rule had been applied to an individual. It would be more of a look at the rule, look at the Constitution and statute, and decide if the rule violates either a constitutional provision or a statutory provision. As much as I have a passion for administrative law, I know that it can be seem kind of dull to people who don't deal with it every day. It's hard for me to believe, but I acknowledge that. So it might help to have a little context for why this bill is so important to the Department of Justice and to agencies. Every year, or every legislative session, this body, the Legislative Assembly, gives agencies the responsibility to sketch in broad brushes of policy by adopting administrative rules. And so at this point, we see ourselves with about 9,600 pages of administrative rules. And if you want to know what that looks like, I would refer you to that Bank of Oregon Revised Statutes that's behind Representative Barker. The rules take up about as much shelf space as that set of statutes, and they're about the same size. So there are lots of agency rules out there. They're very important. Every month, agencies adopt dozens of rules. It's an ongoing process, and in some cases, the rules simply are a recognition that the agency has expertise or will be developing information that will help it fill in the policy decisions that the legislature has made. Because rules are so important, the legislature has developed a process, two processes actually, whereby a citizen can challenge any rule as inconsistent with a constitutional provision or inconsistent with a statutory provision. The first of those is what we call an as-applied challenge. In other words, a person can wait until an agency tries to apply a particular rule to them and then challenge that rule as in violation of some constitutional provision or some statutory vision. Naturally, that's what we call an as-applied challenge. The second way that a person can challenge an administrative rule is the one that's at issue in this very bill, and that's a so-called facial challenge. A person does not have to wait until the rule is applied to him or her, but can simply challenge the rule as on its face, inconsistent with some constitutional or some statutory provision. House Bill 2123 would clarify that when we're looking simply at a facial challenge, a rule that has not been applied in any particular set of circumstances, that the court may not declare a rule invalid simply because it could be applied in some theoretical or speculative way that violates a constitutional or statutory provision. The reason that's important is because it's very, very difficult for agencies to write the perfect rule that is not subject to any set of theoretical facts that might or might not arise, where some particular statute or some particular constitutional provision might not be violated if we leave it to creative people to develop a scenario. Let me give you an example of a rule that might be valid on its face that might be invalid as applied under this set of circumstances. Let's say, for example, and this is a theoretical rule that I don't know of any similar or identical rule that exists, but let's say, for example, that the Oregon Department of Education adopt a rule that said that all sixth graders must actively participate in physical education at least 3 times a week, and at the end of the year they have to pass a little test by doing 50 sit-ups and by running, let's take a mile. Not something I don't think I myself could pass, but let's just say that the Department of Ed adopted a rule that said that. As applied, that rule would probably withstand any challenge. The rule doesn't appear to impose any particular burden on any individual student that would violate a constitutional or statutory provision. But I'm sure that every one of us can imagine a situation in which it might be unconstitutional or might violate a statute. For example, suppose a particular student had a religious objection to participating in physical education for some reason. So as applied to that person, that individual student, that rule might violate the Constitution. Let's say that the student was a student with some serious handicapping or disabling conditions, and no matter what that person did, they would never be able to run a mile. For example, they were using a wheelchair or for whatever reason could never do that. As applied to that person, that rule might violate the federal requirements that every disabled child be given a free, appropriate public education and not be discriminated against essentially based on the person's disability. So as applied to those persons, that rule might very well be invalid as in violation of a constitutional or statutory provision. But on its face, not as applied to anybody, just because you could imagine it would be invalid, on its face that rule would be valid. Now that's the distinction. What we're responding to are a couple of 2005 Court of Appeals decisions that had some language that to the Department of Justice at least seemed to expand the review of facial challenges, seemed to expand the review to allow people to imagine scenarios in which the rule could apply to be in violation of another statute or in violation of a constitutional provision. In other words, seem to sort of mix the two as applied and facial challenges up. We think that it's a better policy decision that when we're just positing examples, that we wait for those as applied challenges to come up. And if we're dealing with a facial challenge, if a rule is capable of being applied in a legal way, the rule should stand. It's, as I said before, it's very difficult to adopt the perfect rule. And what our legislative proposal would do would allow agencies to adopt rules, and on the margins where they're problematic, require people to wait for an as-applied challenge, whereas if you can read the rule and it's simply unconstitutional, simply incapable of being applied in a constitutional or lawful way, the rule will fall. We are trying to turn back to the law as we understood it pre-2005. Now, I understand that there are some concerns with the language of the bill, and in fact, I have a suggestion from Greg Chamoff of Davis Wright Tremaine. I believe Mr. Chamoff is signed up to testify against the bill, and Mr. Chamoff has some alternative language that he'd like to propose. The alternative language that he's proposed looks pretty good to me. I'm not a decision maker on this for the Department of Justice. I'd like to haul it back to the office and show it to people who outrank me, but on its face, I don't see significant concerns with it. So if the committee is not prepared to move the bill today, I would like an opportunity to pull this back and look at it. But at least at this point, it looks pretty good to me. And Mr. Shetter, members of the committee?
Mr. Shetter, did you have some remarks to offer before we open up for questions?
Mr. Chair, I would. For the record, Lane Shetterly, I'm director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, so I'm sort of here as the administrative face on this agency, on this bill, excuse me. Also, I think relevant to the bill, I'm former chair of the Oregon State Bar Administrative Law Section, and so have some practitioners' perspective on administrative law as well. And, of course, I used to sit over there, and this is it's great to be back in this room. This is one of the most egalitarian hearing rooms in the building where everyone is on the same level. I've always thought this is a great hearing room, so it's good to be here this morning. I want to just offer a little perspective on this bill to suggest that what this bill does would be to assure that the court's standard of review of an administrative rule in the context of a facial challenge, again, not where it's being applied to anybody, but this is more the theoretical review of the bill, so this is a facial challenge. It would establish that the court's standard of review of an administrative rule really is the same standard that the court applies to statutes that the legislature adopts. If you pass a bill dealing with criminal procedure, dealing with creating a crime, thank you, and if that statute then is challenged on its face as violating the Constitution, the court's review of the statute on that facial challenge, not where anyone's being prosecuted under this new law, but it's a facial challenge, the court's standard of review would be to ask, can this statute be applied consistent with the Constitution? And if it can be applied consistent with constitutional standards, that statute will withstand a facial challenge. If a local prosecutor or if a case should arise in which that statute is applied in such a way that it violates a person's rights, then the court will address that particular application of the statute in that case on an as-applied basis. But in a facial challenge, the standard for the court will be, can this statute be enforced or applied in such a way that it is consistent with the Constitution? If it can, it will withstand that facial challenge. What has happened here in the context of administrative rules has been to take administrative rules in exactly the opposite direction, where the court will address essentially hypotheticals, because these are facial challenges, so nothing has been done yet. And if a hypothetical scenario can be presented to the court where this rule could be applied foreseeably in such a way that it violates the authorizing statute or goal or constitution, then in that case the court, under the series of cases that have evolved, will say this rule fails. Again, it's the exact opposite analysis from what the court applies to statutes. We think it makes sense that the standard of review should be the same for both, because an administrative rule's relationship to its authorizing statute is largely the same relationship as you have in the way of a statute to the Constitution. And so there is a symmetry there. I would also suggest that to go forward with the standard that the court has offered, where it will examine hypothetical scenarios that might violate
the authorizing statute and thereby render the rule invalid, will significantly complicate the adoption of administrative rules by agencies, in that then in the course of adopting a rule, an agency is going to have to imagine as many scenarios as it can in which this statute might be applied in such a way by somebody that is inconsistent with some authorizing statute, and then draft the rule with those scenarios in mind. Going back to the example that Ms. Shute gave you, the Department of Ed rule that says kids should have PE and take a test at the end of the year, that rule under the construct that we are under currently with the court's review would have to, if the Department of Ed were to adopt that, would have to include then, except in the case of and they provide for exceptions for religious objection, except in the case of, and apply exceptions for disabilities, federal law, ADA. So what you would have then, instead of a simple rule, would be a very complex rule that in itself includes all of these potential manners in which it could be applied inconsistent with statute or other governing law or constitution. I'm aware, and I don't know the bill number, but there is a bill that's been introduced that I think some of you may be co-sponsors on that directs, for instance, that administrative rules be drafted in plain English, plain language. To draft rules in the way that would that the court's approach to review suggests here really takes us in exactly the opposite direction, where the rules become much more complicated and much more detailed in order to anticipate those scenarios that could be presented that would reflect how it could be hypothetically applied in a way that violates a statute or a constitution. So my testimony here is in strong support of this bill. We think that, of course, the statutes control what rules can do. The Constitution controls what rules can do. And to the extent that a rule is capable of being enforced in such a way that it violates either statute or constitution, it is appropriate that application of the rule be challenged on an as-applied basis. But so long as a rule is capable of being applied in such a way that it is consistent with statute and constitution, then the rule should withstand a facial challenge and not fall just on the basis of some hypothetical scenario that might be presented to the court that the agency might not have thought of in its process of drafting. I do commend to you the language that Mr. Chamov brought as an alternate. I agree with Ms. Shute. We've just seen it here this morning, but it sure looks on its face to be satisfactory for what it does, and it's a little, I think, broader description of what we're after. And if we can work something like that out with Mr. Chamov and bring back an amendment, I'd sure be amenable to doing that. But I do appreciate your hearing the bill this morning. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions for either of these witnesses?
Mr. Krieger. Lane, as legislators, and when you were here, we get packets of administrative rules, hundreds of them. Nobody here reads them and understands what those changes are or the reasoning for the change. And there might be an agency or two that you look at real close. I always look at forestry ones. There's a rule on the change of the Board of Forestry and Riparian Zones that BoQuest is involved in. We just got an opinion from the Legislative Council. And I read it before I got here. And because I was on the Board of Forestry and I saw those administrative rules going through, some of them, in fact, are long. They're extremely complex. And as a landowner and a person that's been in forestry, I look at it and say, well, what does this really mean? And you were talking about, you can't make it plain or you can't define it too close. I think that's exactly what we need in administrative rules, so the people that are trying to comply with them know what it is specifically what they're complying with. So I'm kind of making a statement, but on the other hand, I'm looking at the people who have subjected to these rules. What does it really mean? When is it really applied? And they're sitting here trying to figure this out. And so I think in my mind, the more plain it is, the more plain language it is, the easier it is for people to comply.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, if I may, I agree with you. And in fact, and it goes back to my last point, that the This bill takes us in the opposite direction in terms then of the additional layers of drafting that would have to go into a rule to anticipate challenges that might hypothetically be made to the application of the rule. I do agree with you. We are a system of laws, and those laws in some cases devolve to rules in large part because the legislature itself doesn't have the time or in some cases the expertise to develop the specifics of the rules. But I know for a fact, even going into my job at the department, I had to learn a new language and become proficient in new terminology. That's a fact of life, and I think it will be interesting to watch the bill that I mentioned that is in now, directing that rules be drafted in plain and understandable English. And that can go in a very helpful direction, I think, in terms of providing guidance for citizens to understand the rules. My point is that this bill, rather the court's standard that it's adopted for review of administrative rules, actually takes us in exactly the opposite direction, because it will complicate the drafting of rules to anticipate those hypothetical scenarios that would have to then be accepted or addressed some way in the drafting of the administrative rule.
You referred to the two decisions in 2005 where the court seemed to be moving. I mean, you can't speak for them, but what would you think, you know, as an attorney, as someone that sat here, was their thinking for going in that direction? What were they looking at? What were they seeing that moved them to go that way from the pre-position they had?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, that's really hard for me to say. They were interpreting a statute that directs the review of the rules. Both of these cases came through the system or entered into the system before I was at the department, and so I wasn't that conversationally aware with them. I know the department in the last case did take the position that in fact there are ways in which the rule can be applied and that are consistent with the goal in the statute, argued that point. And for whatever reason, and I don't know, we've all seen decisions come out of the court that we disagree with, and we scratch our heads and we wonder why. Sometimes it's clear, sometimes it's not, and I don't want to get into speculating on why the court went that direction, but we think that the direction that it went certainly has some untoward consequences in terms of what it means in the system of administrative rules. Do you know any further about that, Christine?
No, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Krieger, I cannot enlighten you on that.
Sure. Sure, it might be interesting. I would assume these are adjudicated cases, and there'd be nothing wrong with asking someone to come in from the court to kind of explain their thinking.
If I'm not sure they would be willing to enlighten us, but it might be could be improper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question for both or either of you. I hope you can address a concern that I see. He mentioned that it's hard to make a perfect rule, and believe me, we've spent a lot of time on this committee and on others fixing things that weren't perfect. But I'm concerned about perhaps taking away an incentive to make sure that rules and statutes are good if we take away the ability to challenge rules on their face. For example, if you have a rule that is unlawful or improper or not a good rule, and you take away the ability to challenge it on its face, then you have to wait for somebody who may be affected. You have to wait for that person or entity to come up with the time and the resources to challenge it.
Right.
When, given that it's not a good rule to begin with, why should we take away the ability to challenge it on its face? And also, with all due respect to the school example, I think it would be a good thing to take a rule like that and to say there's an exclusion for religious grounds and for handicapped kids. I don't think that would be a bad thing to put those in the rule rather than just have a sort of general all kids have to do this. So I think as a policy maker, it makes sense to put the incentive in there to make sure that the rules and statutes are as good as they can be. So I guess there's a question in that.
Well, feel free to respond.
Yeah, Chair. I think to me it's a balancing, and again, it's the same situation that you are in as you adopt statutes. You want to make them as good as you can. You want to make them as perfect as you can. But you know that when you've adopted them and when they go into print in the ORS, there are thousands of people that are going to be reviewing those, and in many cases, there are opportunities for challenge of those. And you want to make those challenges available to them, but by the same token, to me, the balance is that if a rule, I think the balance is achieved by the direction that this bill goes, that if a rule can be applied in such a way that it is consistent with the statute, then on its face, we allow the rule to be implemented according to that standard. If an agency or if a local government or whoever it is that's implementing the rule then goes beyond what's permitted and does something that's not allowed, it's appropriate that that rule then be subject to challenge on an as-applied basis. That's the balancing standard that the courts have applied to statutes, that allows the statutes to go forward and allows the system to keep working, but recognizing that where those statutes tread on the rights of individuals, an individual should have the ability to raise those concerns by the way of an as-applied challenge. I think that same balancing is appropriate for rules to allow the system to go forward, but provide that where the rule may be applied in violation of some individual's rights or in violation of a statute that authorized the rule, that we preserve then the right to challenge that. Seems to me this is one that allows both worlds to move forward in a way that one isn't trumping the other.
Senator Barker?
I think my question is answered.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any further questions? I have one for either one of you. Who is it that brings facial challenges? Isn't it people who are expecting that they would be ultimately challenging the rule on an as-applied basis? It gives them an earlier shot at it. Is that a fair assessment?
Mr. Chairman, it seems that most... Well, I looked at the cases from about 1991 till now. By far the largest number of facial challenges appear to have been brought by, or largest single category are inmates in the State Department of Corrections. After that, the largest number of challenges seems to be by, I guess I would say organizations, for example, the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association, AFSCME, the State Employee or the State Employees Union.
Aren't they the same potential parties who would ultimately be bringing an as-applied challenge?
Except for the organization, the rule might never be applied to an organization, but it might be applied to the members of the organization.
Right,
it's generally the same group of folks. Right.
Right. Okay.
And it's sort of a preemptive strike on a rule, if you will. That's what and facial challenges.
Right. Okay. If there are no further questions, then I want to excuse this panel and
Thank you.
Invite up Greg Chamov. Ms. Meyer, if you're joining Mr. Chamov, that'd be fine.
Mr. Chair, members.
And actually, since we're going to opponents, I'll have Mary Kyle McCurdy signed up as well. Ms. McCurdy, why don't you join the group here as well, since we got all signed up in opposition to the bill. Mr. Chamov.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Greg Chamov from the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine. It's a pleasure to be back in front of you again. This was a committee that I had the honor of serving as counsel roughly at the time your current counsel was learning to read. Please don't pass this bill. I'm appearing in front of you as an attorney who represents people who are affected by administrative rules, and this change would make it harder for them to protect themselves from rules that should not have been adopted. When this session began, the speaker gave you a set of principles to guide your actions, one of the most important of which was accountability. the adoption of this bill would make agencies less, not more, accountable. The proponents of the bill describe for you a scenario in which a rule might be passed for which there might be a number of exceptions not expressed in the rule but found elsewhere in the law. And as Representative Krieger and Representative Bonamici pointed out, those are exactly the kind of items that ought to be in the rule to help guide the agency not violate statutes, not violate the Constitution, and to allow citizens to know how and when they can comply with the administrative rules. I've given you an example of the kind of situation that this bill could affect. There is a statute that you've adopted that prescribes the circumstances under which there may be a curfew for minors. An emancipated minor is not subject to a curfew. By law, you've chosen to treat those minors as adults. Let's assume for the sake of argument that an agency adopts a rule that says that no minor may be on the streets between midnight and 4 a.m. That law could not apply, or excuse me, that rule could not apply to an emancipated minor, but it doesn't say that. And if a person is an emancipated minor, under this proposal, the minor would have to risk violating a rule to go out on the streets, perhaps get a ticket from a law enforcement officer who, following the rule, but not necessarily following the statute, get a ticket, and then challenge that ticket in court. We owe it to our citizens to craft laws that are easier to follow. When there is conduct that an agency needs to follow or that citizens need to follow that ought to be expressed in the rule, whether it applies to the agency or to the citizens themselves. I've provided you a proposed solution to get at what I think is at the heart of the department's concern with the way the Administrative Procedure Act, as interpreted by the Court of Appeals, currently works. Let me be clear that, at least speaking as a practitioner representing people who are affected by agency rules, my first preference is that this bill enjoy a long and quiet stay in your committee where it remains at adjournment. However, if you choose in your wisdom to tackle this subject, the language that I've proposed is intended to make it possible for the courts to strike down rules that clearly, affirmatively, one can look at and say the Constitution or a statute doesn't allow this to be applied in some significant circumstances. The language that I proposed would be intended to permit an emancipated minor to challenge a rule that said all minors have to be off the streets, or to permit a student to challenge the PE rule that Ms. Chute described to you today. It's intended to give the agencies some leeway when rules are challenged, and the hypothetical situation that someone has thought of to challenge the rule is essentially so inventive, so creative, that it couldn't reasonably have been anticipated. Again, I urge you to continue with the hearing and then move on to other more important topics, including the plain language administrative rules, which I know your Office of Legislative Counsel would appreciate because by law you've directed them to read, and they do, each and every rule adopted by an administrative agency. Thank you.
Any questions? Ms. Meyer.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I'm here today also in opposition to House Bill 2123 and join Mr. Chamoff in his concerns. I know not intentionally, but I believe Ms. Shute actually gave a very good example of the concerns that ACLU would have in this. As proposed, that PE rule would not only violate the federal law, it would violate Oregon law, ORS 659-850, and it would violate Oregon Constitution's Article 2, 3, and 5. The problem is we're supposed to wait for the more vulnerable populations to for the law to be used against them before, so as applied, before they are given an opportunity or forced to challenge it, rather than on its face looking at that and saying that that law never should have been passed that way, to require individuals to wait until it's used against them to then come forward and defend themselves as to why it should not have been applied to them, and to go through the tremendous difficulties and obligation it is to challenge any rule or litigate any issue. So, again, I think Mr. Chamoff really said most of what I needed to say today, and we would urge you not to move forward with this legislation. Thank you.
Ms. McCurdy.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I have longer testimony that I'll submit in written form. I just want to highlight a few points of it. And I also want to point out that one of the two Court of Appeals cases that seemed to have prompted this proposed bill from the Department of Justice is one in which we were involved. That's the City of West Lynn case. As you've already heard, this would eliminate the ability to challenge administrative rules on its face, leaving only case-by-case challenges that a rule violates a constitution, statute, or statewide goal. And we believe this places an unfair and undue burden on ordinary citizens to challenge potentially unconstitutional or exceeding statutory rules as they are applied to them. It's an inefficient way to review rules. It requires every individual case on a case-by-case basis to be challenged, as opposed to the more expeditious method of challenging a rule on its face if it potentially violates statute or the Constitution. And this inefficient and undue burden would extend to all administrative agencies and rules, not just environmental or land use ones. Those happen to be the cases that are most prevalent right now or have been cited to you. This proposed bill is contrary to Supreme Court and Court of Appeals decisions that I've quoted at length in my testimony, so I'm not going to do that here. But I just want to point out the state in those cases, in the two land use and environmental cases, the City of West Lynn and the Water Watch case, they argued in those cases for the position that they would like you to adopt here, that position being that administrative rules cannot be challenged on their face but only as applied.
Excuse me, Ms. McCurdy, you have written testimony?
Yes, I haven't given it to your...
Why don't we get it out in front of the committee members here while we're hearing your remarks.
Again, the Department of Justice made the argument that they're making to you today in the two cases before the Court of Appeals. They argued that the rules at issue there cannot be challenged on their face, but only in an as-applied basis. The court understood and rejected that argument, citing back to a longer line of Court of Appeals cases, allowing rules to be challenged on their face. I'd like to point out that in the case in which we were involved, the City of West Lynn, the rule was not challenged. The rule at issue there, which had been adopted by LCDC, we did not challenge that based on some far-fetched hypothetical scenario at the margins that you've heard painted here. Rather, we challenged that rule on exactly the basis that the agency intended that it be used. And, in fact, in our brief, we quoted from a hypothetical situation written by the Department of Justice as to how they intended that the rule at issue there would be used. This is not a hypothetical, far-fetched example. We do not have the time to litigate every far-fetched example of how a rule might be applied. We quoted in our brief from exactly how the Department of Justice intended this rule to be used. Could we have waited until it was applied in an individual case? Yes, we could have and challenged it then. However, that would have meant that the agency and Metro, in this case of the rule we were challenging, would have gone through a lengthy and expensive process to implement a rule, and then we would have challenged it, and they would have found out that years and money was spent going down the drain implementing a rule that was ultimately exceeding statutory authority. That's not a good use of anyone's resources. We also don't think it's a good safeguard of the legislature's statutory authority. You enact statutes, and there's a lot of agencies that adopt hundreds and thousands of rules, as you know, as you've heard described today. If a state agency has adopted a rule that exceeds the authority you granted it in a statute or skews that authority in some fashion, I would hope the legislature would want that challenged as promptly as possible and not have to wait for individual citizens to challenge that rule as it's applied to them on a case-by-case basis, again, wasting the time and energy of the agencies involved and individual citizens. So, again, we urge you to let this bill stay in this committee, as Mr. Chamoff has described. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That concludes the sign-up of witnesses for House Bill 2123, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2123 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2536. And we have two of the sponsoring legislators present, Representative Gelser and Senator Devlin. I'll invite them forward now. I saw Senator Devlin here a moment ago.
I believe he stepped out just for a second.
Why don't you begin, Representative, or actually, Council, why don't you summarize the bill here for us while we're running?
Happy to. Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2536 establishes the offense of endangering child safety, a Class D traffic violation, for operating a motor vehicle with a passenger who is under 13 years old and is seated in a front seat if a rear passenger seating position is available. It provides that a rear seating position is, quote, available if it is unoccupied by a child under 13 years of age and the position is equipped with a safety belt or a safety harness. The bill requires children under 1 year of age and all other persons who weigh 20 pounds or less to be properly secured with a child safety system in a rear-facing position. It requires children under 8 years of age who weigh more than 40 pounds and are 4 feet 9 inches or shorter to be in a booster seat. The bill removes the exemption from the current seatbelt law for persons who are passengers in a vehicle if all seating positions in the vehicle are occupied.
Representative Gelser, Senator Devlin, I'll let you decide who should be presenting first.
Mr. Chairman, I would be glad to have Representative Gelser start.
Oh, thank you, Senator Devlin. Chair McPherson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Representative Sarah Gelser, and I represent the portion of Benton County, which includes Corvallis and Philomath. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in favor of House Bill 2536, the Child Occupant Protection Law. As a mother of four children and a longtime advocate for all children, I know there is nothing that's more important than keeping our children safe. According to Oregon Vital Statistics, motor vehicle accidents are still the leading cause of unintentional injury and death for Oregon children under the age of 14. Because seatbelt systems continue to be designed for adults, kids require child restraint systems designed for their unique size and internal development. We also know that children under the age of 12 are safest when they are buckled in the back seat of a vehicle. In fact, riding in the back seat decreases the risk of fatal injury to these children by 37%. Today, despite the strong evidence that children's lives will be saved by buckling up in an appropriate safety restraint system, only 52% of Oregon's booster-aged children are riding in booster seats. 52%. Many others are still riding in the front seat, despite the known hazards that this presents. House Bill 2536 will help families and parents by making the safety requirements for children clear. No more guessing about when and whether a child should use a booster seat or ride in the front seat. This bill will require kids under the age of 13 to sit in the back seat when a seat is available. It also requires people under the age of 8 or shorter than 4 foot 9 inches tall to use an appropriate child safety system. It clarifies that children under the age of 1, despite their weight, or kids under the weight of 20 pounds, despite their age, shall be riding in a rear-facing infant seat, which provides for important protection of their neck in a collision. This bill also deletes the current exception for allowing drivers to accommodate more people in a vehicle than there are safety restraint systems to keep them safe. That is simple common sense. Finally, this bill will make Oregon eligible for more than $400,000 of federal funding that can provide education and child safety seats for families in need. This common sense bill provides parents and other caregivers with clear expectations about child safety. It increases the resources to educate families about child passenger safety, and most importantly, it will make Oregon kids safer. I hope you will support this good bill with your vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am glad to be here today as one of the chief sponsors for House Bill 2536 and to speak on its behalf. Child safety issues have always been important issues to many members of the legislature, and I do recall that in 2001 we had a very extensive debate on actually the first booster seat bill that took an extensive amount of work to get through this building, but actually passed, I think, with only one or two votes in opposition when it came to its final vote on the Senate floor. This particular bill has three particular aspects that I hope everyone understands. The first aspect is requiring a baby under 1 year of age or 20 pounds to use a rear-facing child safety system. The second is requiring children under 8 or under 4'9" to use a booster seat in order to be properly restrained in a vehicle. And the third is requiring children 13 or younger to sit in the back seat. These three proposals in combination will, I believe, reduce what is probably the most, and I shouldn't say probably is, but is the most issue that accounts for most fatalities of children 1 through 14 in Oregon, and that is vehicular crashes. In terms of the rear-facing child restraint, I have to tell you that my son, now almost 25 years ago, was in one of the first infant restraint systems, which used to be called a GM love seat, which is one of the seats that reverses. And the reason for that is that in that type of a restraint system, which a very young infant is not capable of really being in any other type of restraint system, what actually restrains the child is the back of the seat. So in essence, when the vehicle comes to a crash or is in a crash, it's the back of the seat that is actually providing the restraint. It is almost impossible to design a restraint system that will actually restrain a very young infant. And so that's why infant seats are common practice now and really very important for children that are up to 1 year of age or up to 20 pounds. We also know that in terms of booster seats, which is the second aspect of this bill, one of the difficulties we had in the last session of trying to explain the necessity of booster seats until we actually came in and tried to demonstrate it to people why seat belts, including lap belts, were not adequate for young children over four years of age and up to about 4'9", 80 pounds, is that your average lap belt and shoulder belt are designed for an adult that's about 5'9", 5'10", weighs 170 pounds. I think one of the most dramatic presentations in terms of on the booster seat bill of why it is so important is the person that we had here in 2001 testifying. It was a young mother who, on a visit to Oregon, who had just recently taken her child out of a normal child restraint seat because the child was then over four years of age and actually under the law could be outside the child restraint seat in Oregon. Well, in a crash that was not a particularly spectacular crash, that child was thrown through the front window of her vehicle and obviously died at the scene. So she became actually a very vocal person for the need for booster seats. I actually believe that the bill that we are proposing now in terms of booster seats is much more understandable to the average Oregonian than our existing law, being the author of our existing law. You have to understand that at the time that we proposed it, 80-pound seats that were designed for young people up to 80 pounds were not as common as they are now, although they were available. And what we basically agreed to in 2001 was a political compromise when we settled at the standard of 6 and 60 pounds, which is, you do not know how many times I have had to explain to people that a 7-year-old that is under 60 pounds still is under the bill required to have a booster seat. I think the way that this bill is written is much more understandable. The third element of the bill, having children in the backseat. As I said earlier, we all know that motor vehicle accidents are the leading cause of unintentional injury and death to Oregon children ages 1 through 14. We also know that the majority of all accidents involve head-on crashes. Frontal and side impacts account for 96% of all crashes. Many of you received this folder from Oregon Safe Kids, and you had a child restraint seat distributed to your offices that you are going to hopefully find a family that needs. If you can't find a family, I would suggest that you maybe deliver it to your local fire department, and I'm sure that they will find a family for you. But in that, there's an item here on one of the sheets that says, children are 63% more likely to be fatally injured if riding in the front seat. 83% of children 12 and younger are riding in the rear seat in Oregon. So it's actually a small number of children that are actually now riding in the front seat. Most parents realize the danger. Also, of course, we all know some of the issues surrounding airbags and young children and why they should not be riding in front seat. And while those people that have modern vehicles have switches to turn off their passenger side airbag, most people do not have such switches. In fact, if they disable the airbag, they basically save the child and take the life of the next adult that is actually in that side of the vehicle. All of these things are relatively common sense. I think most of you here, I won't offend anyone here if I say I'm probably older than a lot of people here, but most of you here probably are of the age that you have friends or you have daughters or you have grandchildren. I don't know how many are that old, but most of these you would think were common sense, and they are. A child under one should be in a restraint system that is rear-facing. A child that is just 4 years old just meets the original requirement for restraint system, has no business being in a lap belt and shoulder belt. They don't fit. And that's why they need a booster seat to bring them up in terms of how they sit in the vehicle so that the lap belt and the shoulder belt fit appropriately. And most people recognize that children are safest in the back seat of their vehicles. What we're trying to do here today and what Safe Kids is always trying to do is to prevent unnecessary injuries to Oregon's children. These three elements combined, I believe, will reduce significantly the number of injuries and most significantly the number of fatalities in Oregon, and I urge your support for the bill.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gelser and Senator Devlin, thank you so much for bringing this important bill. I was at one point in my life a trained safety seat inspector and know this issue very well and commend you for bringing this before us. In fact, I probably traumatized my kids by making them stay in their booster seats too long, and I'm a firm believer in that. I do have a question, though, because and the backseat requirement, because so much of the appropriate size and the booster seat has to do and car seat has to do with the size and weight of the child, not the age. And so a question, because kids come in all shapes and sizes and heights and weights, there are probably some 13-year-old kids who are much smaller than some 10-year-old kids. So I'm just wondering why the decision to say kids under 13 have to be in the back rather than kids under a certain height and weight.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, I'm looking at Representative Krieger there, and I'm looking at Representative Barker, both former law enforcement officers. One of the difficulties you always have in these kind of laws is coming up with a standard that is understandable and that is enforceable. We all recognize that if you look at standard height and weight charts for children, that most of the children would be covered appropriately by whatever law you propose. There are always going to be exceptions. There will be, this would actually put a child outside of a booster seat after age 8. But there are always going to be if you looked at the bell curve for the average height and weights of children, those children that are at the first portion of the bell curve are going to be still quite small, and those children that are at the other end of the bell curve are going to be quite large. If you try to write a statute to take in place every potential exception, you're going to lose some of the understand how easy it is to understand that statute and how clearly possible it is to enforce it. We've talked in terms of when we've gotten into the depths of these issues, everything from age standards to weight standards to height standards, and basically what we've tried to do is pattern it after model statutes, which is what basically has worked out best in other states. I think one of the times when we were debating the first booster seat bill that passed, when we were debating 6 years old or height, I think a lot of us just had the feeling that the average six-year-old was very proud of being six. And if a law enforcement officer asked how old you were, they would say six. But anytime you put something like this in statute, it has to be more understandable for it to be both understandable to the general public and enforceable. I think one of the reasons why Representative Gelser commented on the booster seat compliance rate. Well, it may be only 53%, but it's far higher than it is in states that do not have a booster seat requirement. Mm-hmm. And I think the more that you can communicate clearly to the public the booster seat requirement, the higher rate of compliance you will have. If you try to put 14 different subclauses on exceptions to it, the more difficulty you have communicating what the booster seat requirement is.
So, follow up.
Yeah.
So this change says that if they're 8, they don't need to be in a booster seat, but if they're under 8, but over
4 or 9.
Okay. So it's a weight and height requirement for the
yes.
booster seat, right? Okay.
Or a height and age requirement.
Thank you.
Senator Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Devlin, and thank you, Representative Gelser. I wonder if you could comment on your philosophical sort of thinking about a scenario that I had a constituent talk to me about. This person has a seven-year-old son and a car that has lap belts in the back seat and three-point belts in the front seat. And this person wants to continue having his son in the front seat with an appropriate booster seat. And I wonder if you could just talk about how that might be, how that impacts in this bill.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Reed, it actually might be best in this particular instance to bring up the experts on this who could probably answer your question more clearly. I do believe there is a section in the bill that actually addresses that issue, but I don't have the bill in front of me. So,
And it may be that as to this kind of question, that it would be good to bring people who had developed the language of the bill
yes.
forward. If you'd like to defer to them, Senator
yes,
Devlin,
I would.
That maybe we should do that. I could excuse you and Representative Gelser. And I was going to invite Jeff Merrick to come up. And Mr. Merrick, are there others from your group that developed the bill language that you would like to have accompany you?
Yes, there are. There are several. And I would say there's a bunch of folks, but I'd say at least these four women here.
Didn't mean to kick you out. Sorry.
Well, why don't we why don't you come up with maybe one or two others, since we have limited number of microphones, focusing on those who may have the greatest technical or language background with the development of the bill. Thank you, Representative Gelter and Senator Devlin.
Committee members, my name is Jeff Merrick. I'm an attorney. I frequently represent injured people, injured children, and that's why I'm interested in how do we prevent these tragedies. I volunteered with the committee this past year, but I'm going to defer to the doctor here because he's got a busy schedule.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician from Salem. I represent the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Pediatric Society, and I'm also on the Safe Kids Coalition for the state of Oregon. Just a couple of quick questions. You've heard a lot of the facts, and to address your question more specifically, You have to realize, and I do this all day long, we talk to parents about car seats, booster seats, where the child should be sitting. That's part of prevention. And I point out to them, if they watch NASCAR, if they watch any of the other big races, you'll watch these cars go flying around at 200 miles an hour. They roll, they almost blow up, and then the driver gets out and walks away. And they say, oh, my gosh, how could he do that? Well, that car is built around the driver. They have the whole car built around the driver. You have a roll cage. You have everything in there, everything for safety. Do we do the same for our own, for the public? No, we don't. We make a car that's easy to produce, it's cheap, and gradually, the safety standards come into being, whether it's seat belts, whether it's airbags, whether it's, you know, different rollover protection systems. It's a very slow, gradual process to get the public protected. So I like to point out to them that we like to provide their children with the same level of protection. The whole goal of seat belts, and some of you are old enough to remember that certainly when I had my first car, we didn't even have seat belts in it. When I started medical school, we had an ear, nose, and throat surgeon who kept showing all these different pictures. This is what happens when you hit the steering wheel. This is what happens when you hit the dash. This is what happens when you fly out the window. This is what happens when you do this and that. Over and over and over again, I went home and put in seat belts in my Chevy. Of course, it was rusty, and I had to put in steel plates into the bottom to bolt in things. And some of you may remember those good old days. And even when I started here in Salem, we didn't have, you know, a well-established system. We had to tell parents, you need to put in seat belts, and then you could get car seats at that time, which were a new thing. People said, oh, gosh, you know, it's going to be too expensive. It's going to be too onerous, and on and on and on. It's a very slow process to educate people. Education requires two parts. Legislation to say, hey, we think it's a good idea. We know we can reduce injuries, and we're going to encourage people to talk about them. The whole goal here is to put the child in a restraint system that actually is designed for the child. If you put a child in a seat belt, that's going to come across the neck, going to come across the soft tissues of the abdomen, not come across any bony structures, you're going to kill that child. You can crush, you can have crushing injuries to the liver, to the spleen, to the internal system. You can actually decapitate a child if it's coming across the neck. And we've had pictures of kids, you know, with these injuries, or break their necks, and it's the same injury that they die from. So the whole goal with the booster seat is to get them to fit into the seatbelt system. The question about, is it safer to be in the front? No. They're always safer in the back, whether it's a 33% or 37% or 53%. You know, you can look at the numbers. So we would tell that parent a booster seat with a lap belt is still preferable to sitting in the front with a seat belt system that probably is not going to be designed for that child. You know, we've got a lot of people here to testify, and I don't want to take up too much time, but this is near and dear to our heart, and one of our goals is to prevent injuries. And if we know that we can reduce mortality and morbidity, and that we save money, not only on the state level, because oftentimes these children who are severely injured ended up on Medicaid and end up needing, you know, state tax dollars or federal tax dollars to support them for the rest of their life, we think it's a worthwhile goal. These things are slow. The public gets educated. We have more and more people doing this. We need to increase that rate. And this is in conjunction with education, but we can actually bring in some, you know, the law enforcement aspect that people listen to that, whether it's going to be cars, you know, seat belts, whether it's car seats, whether it's booster seats, bike helmets, you name it. It's a slow, gradual process, but this is all part of that. And what we want to do is try to make sure that those kids are as safe as possible in motor vehicles, and that this bill addresses some of the issues that we note are, at this point, could be improved on. I'll stop here.
Any questions for Dr. Lace?
I just have a question. Thank you. In response to Representative Reed's question, in his example, there were only lap belts in the back.
Yes.
And you said to use a booster seat, but I'm looking at this here that says never use a booster seat if there's only a lap belt. So I'm confused about that.
I'll defer to somebody else.
I just want to make sure that we get this question answered for Representative Reed. Sure.
Representative McPherson, our chair. I'm Ruth Harshfield. I'm the Executive Director for the Alliance for Community Traffic Safety. I also run the Child Safety Seat Resource Center in the state of Oregon, and I am a certified child passenger safety technician instructor. for your particular situation, when we passed the booster law in 2001, we made an exemption saying that if you only had lap belts in the back seat, you could ride in the front seat utilizing a lap shoulder belt for children in boosters. Booster seats do require lap shoulder belts, so you wouldn't be able to use a booster seat in the back with just a lap belt. However, since that time, we're seeing a lot of improvement in the technology and availability of child safety seats with built-in harnesses for children over 40 pounds. So there are now seats available, readily available, that go up to 65 pounds, even up to 80 pounds, that can be used with just lap belts. So I would not say to a parent, if they called me with that scenario now, with the current law, that they should put their child in a booster in the front seat with a lap shoulder belt as opposed to the back seat. What I would say is the back seat is over 37% safer than the front seat. We have no statistics to show that a child riding with a lap-only belt in the back seat is at any higher risk than a child riding in the front passenger seat with a booster and a lap shoulder belt. We don't have any statistics that show that they're safer in the front seat. We do have statistics that show they're safer in the back seat. And currently what I would say is it's up to you to decide what you're most comfortable with as a parent. With the change in the law, we would now be saying children under the age of 13 need to be in the back seat, and I'd be glad to mail you a list of all of the child safety seats that are now rated to the higher weights.
Senator Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had an elderly mother in her late 80s. She was small. She was small all her life, but she would probably weigh under 100 pounds. And at the time I'm thinking, when my kids were 12, they probably would have been safer in the front seat than my mother would have been. So, but by this law, it would actually make me in violation to do that.
The change in the law would be once they're 8 years of age, no matter how tall they are, they can then, they don't have to ride in a booster seat at that time. Well,
but in the back, it says that a kid under 13 has to ride in the back seat if there's a space available, and the space available is designated by somebody. See, an 89-year-old wouldn't make that seat available. They'd say, well, you're 89, sit in the front. And I mean, it just, it's one of those things where I know if the intentions are good, and virtually, you know, in most cases that would work, but in my case it wouldn't have. So it's just one of those things that, you know, I mean, I know how in working here and writing laws, you have a good focus and you write a law, and somebody says, but wait a minute, what about this? And so then you have these problems, and that would, to me, might be a problem there.
Representative Barker, if I might respond to that and tell you a little bit about how this committee worked. The committee is populated by medical, public health, and other professionals. They went with where the data took them, and you're right, there are outlying areas that it won't cover, and so you do what the data supports and what makes sense. We talked about the age cutoffs, and to some extent they are arbitrary. You know, we believe that everybody 4'9", whether they're 89 years old or not, if they're under 4'9", they should be in a booster seat. But we know that that's not politically feasible to tell 25-year-olds, well, you're only 4'5", you have to have a booster seat. So we made the cutoff, and of course, we're not the only people who saw the data. The National Highway Transportation Safety Administration saw the data. They've given us the incentive to, given the states the incentive to follow where the data takes us, and that's where it takes us. With this bill, it's like you say, there are outliers.
Mr. Merrick, I'm not sure we had you formally identify yourself for the record at the beginning, but just to make sure.
Thank you. My name is Jeff Merrick. I'm an attorney, and I was working with the committee this year. And I also didn't get a chance in my written materials to thank you, Mr. Chair, for your early leadership on this. Your early leadership and your guidance really gave us encouragement to continue on with this work. It's very important work.
Dr. Lewis.
Thanks. The only comment I would make is that this bill is about children. And so our goal is to protect children. I'm sure you love your mother-in-law, and I'm sure that everybody fits into that family structure, but this is addressed towards children, and we're looking at, you know, specific age groups. So we would say what's best for children, you know, obviously you have to make some trade-offs, but it would be in our desire to protect that child in that situation, and not to say that the mother-in-law is worth less or more than that child, but we're after children protection here. So,
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, thank you. On occasion, I've had a couple nieces with me who would be the younger, lighter, be in restraint. But my son was 5'9", 200 and some pounds, wrestler, exercised, and he's 12 years old. His sister is 100 pounds, and she's 14. So I'd be in a position to having to put him in the back and making her vulnerable in the front seat. And I wasn't doing that. I always reversed that because of his size and maturity. So I'd be putting my daughter at risk to comply with your laws simply based on age, and that's not good.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be clear, my concern here right now is the, as you indicate, somewhat arbitrary age delineation for 13 or younger, because we're talking about eighth grader and potentially a freshman in high school that would not be allowed to sit in the front seat. Ms. Harshfield, you indicated that we're talking about common sense situations here. You had data that supported the scenario 33% or 34% were safer sitting in the back, but no data to say that they would be as safe sitting in the front seat. That concerns me. And could either of you clarify for me what in the current law is not working as we look back at trends? I think I heard some testimony that we're seeing an increased compliance or level of safety for children. So what is not working?
Well, there's a couple things. First of all, we've got these standards based on weight when the issue with booster seats is height. We've got now better booster seat capability than we had when the law was written, and Senator Devlin addressed that. There are seats now that are capable of taking the bigger children. And I'll leave the rest to you.
Thank you. Chair McPherson and Representative Flores. I think that what we're finding is that parents are very confused about what the current law is, what best practice is, how they can best protect their children. And what we're seeing oftentimes is not the 13-year-old child who's a sophomore or a freshman in high school, but we're seeing, you know, 6-, 7-, 8-year-old kids riding in the front seats. And it's our younger children really that we're wanting to protect. And the national recommendation for best practice is children under the age of 13 in the back seat. And I think that message is out there for parents. They're hearing that, and then they're calling us oftentimes to find out what the current law is, and what we say is it doesn't address seating position. Recommendation is for your children to ride in the back seat. And most of the calls that we receive, they're seeking that best practice or what's the safest way to protect their children. So those would be the suggestions that we would make. You know, there's some other people here today who maybe can testify to the physical development of children in relation to being 12 or 14 to answer the other concern. It's also, you know, the front passenger seat, when you are positioning the seat far back from the dash, you're using the left shoulder belt, you have airbags. It is a seating position that has provides some safety, but we've just consistently seen children are not big enough to fit in that seating position, and we're looking to protect the majority of children, then that is a national recommendation that we're, you know, modeling our law after in order to be able to send the message that there is an option and that children should be in the back seat.
I'm sorry. I will have further questions.
Representative Cameron, and I'll come back.
I can yield to a follow-up.
Representative Flores, proceed.
Thank you. And I understand that there is some, obviously, a financial incentive for federal funds in the event this bill were to be put into Oregon statute. Can you give me some indication of how many states are currently utilizing the recommendation from the federal government in this regard?
My understanding is that Chairman McPherson and Representative Flores. My understanding is that there are not very many states currently. The funding was made available recently. I know that Washington State has adopted the law, and it will go into effect in July, and they should be eligible for those funds. I probably need to defer to Troy Costales. He probably has a more complete answer on which states may actually be accessing those dollars at this time.
Thank you.
And if we have a witness who has to leave at 10 o'clock, so if we can make this the last question for this panel,
Representative Cameron, and then we'll divide up another.
Sure. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank all three of you and for just putting their child safety forefront here. Concern I have, it probably doesn't even relate to child's safety, is the deletion of any person who is in a passenger vehicle if all seating positions in the vehicle are occupied as an exception to the seatbelt law. Can we discuss why we did that? That doesn't impact child safety.
If I may, Chair McPherson and Representative Cameron. If a child, or if any person in the vehicle is not being restrained, in the case of a crash, that person becomes a missile that's going to fly around within the interior of the vehicle and run into anybody else who's not involved. And I think that giving the impression that it's okay to have more people than you have restraint systems for does endanger the children riding in that vehicle. What we often find, or what we're seeing in crashes, is that the adults are buckled and the kids are being held. Babies are being held on someone's lap because the understanding is, well, I can hold onto this child. And when you look at crash forces, you know, a 20-pound infant, and you're involved in a crash even at 30 miles per hour, that child is being pulled away from you at over 300 pounds of force, and there's no way you can hold on to that child. So I think that having numerous passengers who are not restrained in the vehicle puts everybody in that vehicle at risk.
Just a follow-up. So how does this impact people that are in motorhomes, campers, fifth wheels, vehicles that are predated seatbelts that might not have seatbelts in them today?
The exemption for not having seatbelts would continue to be in the, you know, if you have an older antique vehicle or a vehicle that did not come with seatbelts, you're still not required to put seatbelts into that vehicle. We're just addressing the issue of more passengers than available seating positions.
Okay, thank you.
If those are all the questions for this panel, why don't we excuse them, and I'll invite up Dr. Mel Cohn, who I understand has a time constraint, and let's have him joined by Brett Barnum and Tamara Franks.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, thank you very much. For the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Department of Human Services, and I'm pleased to be here to testify in support of this bill today. You've already heard a lot of information about this bill, including data, and I would just like to emphasize that, you know, motor vehicle crashes are the leading cause of death for children in this age group. And it's something that we need to take very seriously from a public health point of view, and I think this bill makes a great deal of sense. I also speak to you as a pediatrician and as a father as well. What happens in a motor vehicle crash can actually be fairly gruesome to young children if they're not properly restrained. A belt that's on the soft part of the abdomen instead of on the hips can cause terrible internal organ damage. A belt that is riding too high up on the neck can actually literally hang a child. It's a very, very serious thing, and something that really is very preventable with the technology that we have available. You have my written testimony in front of you, and really I just want to add my voice to the chorus in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Any questions for Dr. Cohn? And why don't we excuse you, since I know you have some time constraints, and we'll go on to Officer Barnum.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, fellow representatives. My name is Brett Barnum. I'm a police officer with the City of Portland. I've been a police officer in the state of Oregon for 16 years, with the City of Portland for 14. The last 10 years, I've been assigned to the traffic detail motorcycle unit, so I have extensive experience with traffic enforcement related issues. I'm also a child safety seat instructor as well as technician, and have been for the last 3 years, and through the Child Passenger Safety Resource Center and Save Kids have become very involved in child passenger safety issues. Thanks for taking time to listen today. Senator Devlin tapped right on exactly where I was going, the law enforcement perspective. It seems throughout testimony today in this bill and other bills, we're talking about making it simpler, easier. Easier for people to understand. It's got to be easy for law enforcement to understand. We have hundreds and hundreds of vehicle codes to remember on the spot. We have hundreds and hundreds of ORSs to remember and make a split-second decision on sometimes. We need to understand this or else it doesn't get enforced. Law enforcement is the first line of defense in not only educating the public, but enforcement. And when you issue a citation for endangering child passengers to a motorist, whether it's a parent, an uncle, a grandparent, an aunt, it hits them. They really feel it when they see that they're endangering their child passenger. In my packet, I've included a couple examples of a couple of crashes in Portland with some color photos for you, because sometimes people need to see a visual. Just sitting here testifying today and listening to other testimony, you don't get to see what happens. There's an example in there of a success with a booster seat. There's also an example of a failure with a booster seat with a child that almost died. That booster seat was used inappropriately. It was being used, but it was being used inappropriately. Why? Because the grandmother didn't have the education. She didn't understand. Possibly because law enforcement couldn't explain it to her properly. It makes sense. This bill makes sense. Of 900 men and women at the Portland Police Bureau, I'm the representative to speak for them. I think I can also speak for the thousands of police officers throughout the state and talking with them at different traffic safety conferences that this bill needs to be simple. 4'9" is easy for us to remember. And the whole lot of things to remember as a police officer, 4'9" and of teenage years. So they need to be a teenager in order to be in a front seat. It's easy for us to remember. It's easy for us to teach our other law enforcement personnel. 4'9", it's become a catchphrase. We're starting to see ODOT put up billboards. But it's through law enforcement's enforcement and education and understanding that we can actively attack this and help save lives and prevent injuries. There are a lot of people up here who have testified as far as the injuries and soft tissue damage, and that's far beyond my knowledge. There are also other experts that will testify, different types of car seat systems. Yeah, I'm an installer and an instructor, but I don't have the expertise that these people do. They see it on a daily basis. And when I see a child driving down the road that's not properly protected, I cringe. It affects us all. We all have sons or daughters. We all have nieces and nephews. And we all may have grandchildren. So it does affect us all. But we need to be able to properly educate them. We need to make it simple. And of the Portland Police Bureau, as a representative today, the Police Bureau does support this bill in its entirety and all of the different facets that go along with it.
Thank you, Officer Barnum. Any questions? Thank you very much. Ms. Frank.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Barker.
How can we get around the some of these, the, you know, like my mother when she was that old and frail? So I don't want to get a ticket, so do I put her at risk? I mean, the car I have is even newer than what he's speaking of. If there's not enough weight in that front seat, it automatically shuts the airbags off. But how can we get around some of these issues? And Representative Krieger's big son, small daughter, different age, you know. So, I mean, you don't want to put the kid where you're trying to save lives. How do we get around those problems, or can we?
If it were a perfect world, we'd be able to. And we all know it's not a perfect world. What we're going to do by achieving what we're looking at achieving through this bill is protect and put a blanket over the vast majority of situations. Every police officer has a reasonable opportunity to understand somebody's position. We're humans just like everybody else. It doesn't mean we got to give a citation. We're not bound by issuing citations to everyone. We can help educate them and further educate and say, you know, I know what we did for my grandmother when she started shrinking a little bit was we put her in what I call an adult booster seat and put her on some pillows. We just raised the foam up so that lap shoulder belt fit firmly over her shoulder instead of across her neck because she fell to the same dangers that any child not being properly installed with a booster seat would with a neck injury. And with Representative Krieger's situation, there are some tough choices that need to be made by parents. And I think if it were explained to law enforcement on the roadside, in the parking lot, wherever they were stopped, I think it would make sense. And I think most police officers throughout our state use a lot of good judgment and common sense.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I haven't had the need to use a booster seat or car seat for a while. So I wonder if this covers, there's some, I think, minivans that have built-in child restraint systems. Do they qualify as an approved booster seat or car seat under this statute?
Yeah, I'll refer that to Tammy Franks for her expertise in that area.
Yes, integrated seats and vehicles will also be covered through this law, our approved child safety seats.
Any further questions?
Just one more comment, Mr. Chair. I have two boys myself. They're 9 and a half, and I've mentioned them in my testimony there. They're 9 and a half and 11. And it's amazing to see, going through these different conferences and seeing the slides that doctors bring to us and the emergency room physicians bring to us, it's amazing to see the damage that can be done to children. And once my child was available to be out of a booster seat, it was a huge relief for us. It was one less thing we've got to pack. It's one less thing we've got to transfer to a different car. But once I saw these photos and I was educated, I understood the significance. It scared me to death. And my 9 and a half year old, who's only 4'7", still sits in a booster seat. He doesn't mind it. It's not that big of a deal. They're really lightweight. They're easy to take from car to car. My 11-year-old is 4'10", and it's amazing to see the difference while they sit in the back of my vehicle with the same size safety belts, how just a couple of inches makes all the difference in the world for these kids to fit properly. My 11-year-old, it's low across the hips and over the collarbone. It's using those large bones to protect his upper body from being thrown around in a vehicle. Whereas my 9 and a half year old stands 4'7". It goes right across his stomach and right up his neck. And when I saw those videos and different photos and those sorts of things, and that's why I've kind of included some photos for you guys, it scared me. And I don't want my son not to see another day. So, and time again, we're first responders. We see the tragedy.
Ms. Frank said, if you have some comments to offer, in addition to what the remarks you made before.
Yes. Chair McPherson and members of the committee, please allow me to introduce myself. I am Tamara Franks. I am a nationally certified child passenger safety technician. I am certified as a special needs instructor in the state as well. A special needs transportation instructor. I am the child passenger safety coordinator for Legacy Health System as well as for Twilley Healthcare. But I'm here today for my most important job as a mother of two children. I've worked in this field since 1999. I'm very active in this field. I have taught this subject over and over and over, but I've also experienced this firsthand. I hope I can do this. In 2004, my family was involved in a severe crash. At the time of the crash, my son was six and a half years old and under 60 pounds. My daughter was 4 years old and right at 40 pounds. Both of them were seated in booster seats in a minivan. We were on vacation in Ohio. In Ohio, at that point in time, neither of my children were required to be in a booster seat by law. They would have been allowed to be in the seatbelt system. Had I not known what I know and made the effort to take their seats with them, I am fairly convinced that if not one, but both may not be here today. We had spent a beautiful day at the zoo with my family. We had stopped 0.3 miles from our destination of being home at my parents' house. We were stopped in a two-lane highway, and a gentleman in a car behind us in a four-door sedan never saw us and drove into us at 55 miles per hour. My children walked away from that crash traumatized, crawling out the window after the doors were pried open. One crawled out the window. The other one came out the door after it was pried open, shut down the highway for over an hour, but my children walked away. We have dealt with nightmares. We have dealt with hesitation to get in a vehicle. My son would not leave the crash scene. I could not get the 6 and a half year old off the two-lane highway so it could reopen because he would not leave the scene without a booster seat. We had to find a booster seat for that child to leave. I believe in these. The adults had injuries in the vehicle. These children walked away. I am so proud of them. If you were in your office on last Tuesday when we were here for Safe Days Kids at the Capitol, you may have seen them. They were the kids here delivering booster seats. My son is now 9 and a half years old. He is about 4 feet 10 inches and has graduated to the vehicle seatbelt system, but he believes in it. He was here delivering booster seats, 91 of them as a matter of fact, last Tuesday. They did a great job. My daughter is 6 and a half now, and she also, she still sits in a booster seat and was here on Tuesday as a learning day from school, and they actually both gave talks at school on Wednesday about their experience and being involved in this cause because we believe in it. I have them here today. I was able to kiss them goodbye this morning because they were sitting in booster seats. What we are asking you to adopt is no more than what the American Academy of Pediatrics has been has a policy as their best as the best means of transportation for children. I have included the American Academy of Pediatrics policy for you. It's attached to my testimony. Legacy Health System at this point in time already adopts these policies and promotes this to every child who receives some type of care at any of their facilities, inpatient or outpatient. So we're just asking you what is already best practice and what is out there. And I'm asking you as a parent of children who are of this age to please adopt this or to please seriously consider this bill because it protects our children as well. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Franks? Thank you, ma'am. We have three more witnesses who are signed up, and I'd like them to come, I think, up for a single panel here. Tori Costales, Joanne Fairchild, and Denise Cardinale. I'm just going to recommend, just taking in the order I just called out, which is the order of sign-up, Mr. Costales.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I won't repeat any of the prior testimony. This bill brings together multiple provisions. I wanted to answer one of the questions brought up by the committee. There is federal funding available to the state of Oregon that would flow through the safety division, approximately $500,000 per year of federal money that would flow through the safety division for child safety seat booster seat programs that would go towards education, enforcement, as well as making seats available to places around the state. The one provision in this bill that triggers that funding is the 4'9" and 8-year provision. All the other elements of this bill are, as previously testified to, are national recommendations from different associations for best things to do for child safety. There was a question about eligibility. I think Representative Flores had asked that, and so I wanted to make sure to address that to let you know that's the provision there that triggers the funding. As I mentioned, $500,000 per year. There are 6 to 10 states currently that qualify for this funding. It is anticipated that if we have this bill in place and enforceable before September 30th, that's the trigger date for Oregon's application, in law and enforceable by September 30th, we have the ability to apply for funding for 2008, and then there would be subsequent 2 years of funding under the current federal transportation bill that would come to Oregon, so approximately $1 million in the 09-11 biennium for this program. The funding from our office would be used to supplement our current program, which is talking about booster seats and recommending to parents and grandparents, uncles and aunts, the 4'9", as well as kids in the back seat. We do that as a public information campaign. We would alter that under this bill to turn around and talk about it as being the law as well. As previous testimony indicated, we do have high use rate across the state in safety belts, as well as high backseat usage and, again, the 52% current compliance with the law for booster seats, and that's done by a survey all around the state of people actually looking in the vehicles and seeing what kids are doing, where they're seated, what types of belts or seats or booster seats they're currently using. Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd be more than happy to answer the questions on the implementation side, at least from the funding or program side, because others have already covered the elements and the particulars of the bill.
And we do appreciate you bringing that that other dimension. Council, do you have a question?
Just a quick one. Do you have a citation to the federal? Is it a statute or a rule that's involved?
Mr. Chair and Council, Tomlinson?
Yeah.
Get that right? Under the federal law, the U.S. Department of Transportation Safety Lube Bill, Section 2011 is the where the criteria is listed, and that's also the language in which Oregon would my office would file for the federal funding.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Just to make a statement, I don't want to pass any legislation because it brings dollars. I want to bring it because it's the right policy. We continue to have the carrot hung out here by the federal government. Not always is that best. Not maybe specific to safety, but in other arenas that we deal with. We get ourselves caught up in wanting those federal dollars, and then we develop rules that probably we wouldn't have if it hadn't been for the dollars.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Costales. Joanne Fairchild.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is, for the record, my name is Joanne Fairchild. I'm a trauma nurse coordinator at Legacy Emanuel Hospital. I'm a former flight nurse, emergency department nurse, and critical care nurse. I also chair the Oregon Safe Kids Legislative Committee, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2536. I did attach to my testimony several research articles that were written on the issues that we are addressing in this bill. And but I also, I'm a visual learner, so I didn't include anything graphic in case you're worried about that. But I do have several pictures attached to my testimony that I would like to go over. The first one shows correct and incorrect restraint of a six-year-old in a motor vehicle crash. The top simulation is a child in a booster seat, and it shows the limited forward movement of the upper body of the child. The lower panel shows what we see with children. My niece kind of pointed this issue out to my father when she was little and walking on the tide flats with him, trying to keep up with him, and she kept running and falling in the water and finally grabbed his pants and said, "Grandpa, you have long legs, I have little legs." And that's the issue around booster seats. The seats in our cars are designed for adults. The belts in our cars are designed for adults. And when, to make your lap belt fit correctly, you have to have your, as I tell the kids, your bottom all the way back in the seat, sit up straight, put your belt on, and pull up on the shoulder harness. When our children have their bottoms all the way back in the seat, their legs stick straight out in front of them, which is miserably uncomfortable. So they do either what the child in the bottom frame does, which is scoop forward, put their shoulder harness behind them. Now they have nothing restraining their upper body. And not only does that cause head and abdominal injuries, but when their head smacks the back of the seat in front of them, it virtually stops their head. Their body keeps going and gives them really severe spinal cord injuries. Or the next picture is the thing that we see most commonly. The picture on the left shows my friend Michael, who was six at the time we took this picture. And because he couldn't bend his knees with his bottom all the way back in the seat, he scooched forward, and that ends the lap belt is now up around his belly, the shoulder harness across his neck, and the easy fix for that is a booster seat. And the good news for the child is they can see out the window, and it's much more fun for them on the ride. Also, we're wider than kids, so booster seats move the adult belts in closer to their body. The next picture is the most graphic I brought, and this is a seven-year-old who was in an adult lap shoulder belt. And you can see the injuries that we are seeing with these kids because they go underneath the lap belt. They pop their intestines, lacerate their livers, break their backs, and he did actually have his lap belt in front of him, but he got a neck injury from that. The next picture addresses the rear seating position, and I've been listening to the questions. There was research actually done at OHSU here in Oregon that showed it is not a height and weight issue. It is an age issue, and it has to do with the internal organ development. Children have larger internal organs proportionally than adults do and less abdominal musculature. And so regardless of the height and weight of the person, as we grow older, our organs are more covered by our rib cage and more protected by our rib cage. And so the research is showing that it actually is an age issue, and the age issue is dependent on these internal organ developments. So that's why the research, they believe, is showing that it's an age issue and not a height and weight issue. And the most severe crashes are head-ons. And the farther you are from the hit, the less transfer of energy, which means the less injuries, and that's why the back seat. I tell kids all the time when I'm teaching in the schools that if I could figure out how to drive from the back seat, I'd still sit back there unless there was a child that needed that seating position more than I did. And the last picture is the good news, and this is a pickup truck that the driver hit black ice. The pickup truck rolled 2 complete times into the creek, and the grandmother, who was driving properly restrained, walked away, as did her 2 grandchildren, who were both properly restrained in the back seat in their booster seats. I also included the National Transportation Safety Board Administration's recommendations on proper restraints for children in the cars, which address all these issues. And lastly, I just want to reiterate about having more passengers in the car than you have safety systems. I was talking about this at a safety belt class, and a young mother burst into tears. And so after the class, I stopped and talked to her, and she said that her ex-husband would pile the whole neighborhood into his car, and her children were not buckled. And she said, I called 911, and they said, that's legal. He can have as many children in that car as he wants to, as long as the available safety belts are in use, you can have other children in the car. I also worked with a young family who had more passengers than safety belts, and so as Ruth Harshfield said, they had the baby because the mom thought she could hold on to the baby in a crash. The baby was the one that was unbuckled, even though there was a child safety seat that they stuck in the back of the van. And the driver fell asleep, the van rolled, and the only person that, and it wasn't just injuries, the baby was dead on the side of the road where the baby landed, and all the adults that were buckled in the vehicle walked away from the crash. The baby flew from the crash. I also am asking for this legislation because I do teach safety belt classes, and I have parents that are very confused because law enforcement comes in and says the law is 6 and 60 pounds, and then I say, but that's not what's safest for our children. So we're trying to make the parents in this state look to our laws to tell them how to keep their children safe, and that's why we've asked for these issues. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. And I guess my concern with the issue you brought up again is, of course, if I was in a vehicle without enough seat belts, I would put my children in. And I think I want, for the record, to be supportive of taking care of our children first. If there's a vehicle with 8 adults in it, and there's only buckling for 7 people, that's my concern, is the fact that now we've many times, I'm not advocating that we take away the safety of the children. They should be put first, and anybody who thinks they can hold on to their baby, I understand that is a figment of their imagination. So my issue is, and maybe there's some language we could put in there, that if there is as long as the children are taken care of first, that maybe an adult can make a decision to put an extra person in the car to go 5 miles from where they, drop the vehicle off into a stadium or something like that without being, subject to a ticket or violation of a law.
Okay. Any comments, or you don't feel no need to respond?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron. Again, the concern with that is, and I tell people this all the time in safety belt classes, if you look at the person sitting next to you, imagine them shot directly into you at 35, 50 miles an hour, whatever, because anything unbuckled in your car, and I don't know if any of you see the Mythbusters on TV, but they did prove that you can be killed by a box of Kleenex flying through your vehicle at 60 miles an hour, and adults weigh considerably more than that. We have had children in this state killed by adults that were unrestrained flying through the car into the child. So that's my concern with any unbuckled people in the car, that in a crash they become a missile. Thank you.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just also want to add for the record that if you do allow unrestrained adults in the car when there's children in the car, the children remember that. And I heard we went 2 miles with my brother sitting on the floor of the van 1 year, and we heard about it from the kids for years. Well, that was the time Uncle Jim didn't have a seatbelt on, right? So the kid sends the wrong message to the kids that you're allowing somebody unrestrained in the car.
We have one remaining witness, Denise Cardinale. And Ms. Cardinale, we need to break here quite soon because we have your due on the floor. But if okay. You could briefly tell us your views.
My name is Denise Cardinale. I come to you as a pediatric nurse. I'm a child passenger safety technician instructor, but I'm really the community person. I volunteer to run the Benton County discount car seat program. As a pediatric nurse, I took care of the child who was parents were following the law in another state and was in the seat belt. It severed his spinal cord. He spent weeks in the ICU, months in rehabilitation. To this day, he walks with full leg braces, and all of his toileting functions require medical intervention. His sibling, who was a year younger, was in a booster seat and walked away from the crash. So it really impacts his life. In the community, I see parents who are confused. I see daycare providers who don't understand that what the law is really not what's safe, and they're confused. So I think that having a law that really tells parents, daycare providers, schools, what it is to keep our children safe is important. In terms of the question about federal funding, in my mind, it's kind of a nice bonus because this law brings forward what is safe practice, and to have some extra money would be great. Running the Benton County car seat program, we're always looking for more funds to buy more car seats. So I think that we're not changing the law to get money, but having the side benefit of having brought the law up to safe practice, we'll have some extra funds to do more communicating. And one other example I'd like to add that wasn't in my testimony, when I was in Vermont, I worked very closely with our state low-income program. We had a family who we'd work very hard with to get their children properly restrained. We consistently knew that their children were properly restrained. Their children were both killed in a crash, and they were killed by the unseat-belted occupant who broke their necks. Reconstruction confirmed that the children were properly restrained, so it was that unrestrained occupant that killed them. So I do think that we really do need to look carefully at that issue. If there's other questions I can answer, I'd be happy to do that.
Any questions for Ms. Cardinale? Representative Cameron.
Yeah, I haven't heard any testimony today about how this applies to public transportation and standing up in a bus or standing up in the MAX train. Is this have anything to do with public transportation and why we don't restrain or require people to be restrained there either? Is this just about private transportation?
Representative McPherson, Representative Cameron, currently there aren't devices on public transportation that allows for buckling, and there's huge amounts of issues, most of them monetary, that dictate that. So when Senator Hatfield was in the bus crash, I thought maybe they'd actually start looking at how we can keep people more safe in public transit too, and that hasn't happened. So we're not asking for that, and the biggest issue is there just aren't devices in public transit. But I'd be happy to give you the long answer on that, but I know you have to break.
Yeah, do we understand, Ms. Fairchild, that this bill applies to passenger automobiles?
Yes,
and,
yes. Not public
not
transit.
Not public transportation.
No, it does not.
If there are no further questions, then I'll excuse this panel and close the public hearing on House Bill 2536. And that concludes our business for the day. Thank you, committee. We're adjourned.